Analysis: in Iran, the Netanyahu doctrine is now facing its ultimate test. Israel has failed in the past to change the map of the Middle East. Netanyahu is gambling that this time, he can succeed. By Anshul Pfeffer. This war with Iran, now in its fourth week, is Donald Trump's and Benjamin Netanyahu's war. A joint venture. That's an obvious observation. The lead-up to the war included Netanyahu's incessant urging of American presidents to confront Iran militarily, Trump's rash promise to Iranian protesters that help is on the way, his flush of victory after removing Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, and his abandoning of the traditional presidential role of restraining America's Israeli partner. But it's too easy to just put this war down to two men and leave it at that. Without this toxic couple coordinating between Jerusalem and Washington, we probably would not have this war right now. But a war between Iran and Israel, or Iran and America, and even a war between Iran and an Israeli-American partnership, was in the cards for decades. So much of what Iran and Israel have been preparing and planning, the weapons, the proxies, the not-so-secret alliances, have been leading up to this. And you don't have to be of Trump's generation to understand how deeply the saga and humiliation of the hostages held at the Tehran embassy has been imprinted on the collective American psyche for nearly half a century. What-ifs are often rather fatuous exercises of pretend history, but they do have their uses. Perhaps, under different leaders and in other circumstances, a war between Iran and Israel and America could have been averted. But there are plenty of entirely plausible scenarios in which such a war could have broken out under different leadership. Israel's F-15 and F-16 fighter jets were purchased and upgraded specifically with extra fuel tanks and electronic warfare systems for long-range strikes, which were being rehearsed under previous Israeli prime ministers before Netanyahu returned to office in 2009. The same is true of the Arrow missile defense system, developed and ordered by Israeli governments even before Netanyahu's first term in 1996. Every Israeli prime minister in the past four decades, from Yitzhak Shamir, Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres in the 1990s, to the most recent Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid, with Ehud Barak, Ariel Sharon and Ehud Olmert in between, has been preparing and laying the groundwork for this war. And throughout the entire period, one man led Iran, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, who not only predicted Israel's destruction by 2040, but directed his regime to invest untold billions in manufacturing and deploying hundreds of thousands of missiles to Iranian proxies surrounding Israel, with the aim of one day making his prophecy a reality. An Iran which no longer threatens its neighbors and Israel could indeed transform the region. But if they fail, rather than toppling the regime, they could topple instead the already shaky international markets. That doesn't mean war was inevitable or that it would have been prosecuted in the same fashion and with similar aims to those of Netanyahu and Trump. War was postponed for many years as Israel, with American support, pushed back against Iran's encroachment with a combination of deterrence, sanctions, and covert operations. Smaller wars did break out with Hezbollah and Hamas, and diplomacy played a role as well. For example, the nuclear deal with Iran in 2015 was nowhere near the peace in our time panacea that the Obama administration presented, but neither was it Munich, as Netanyahu claimed. It was an effective, though limited, arms control treaty that should have given Israel a decade's respite from the nuclear issue. At least that is how most of Israel's security establishment viewed it, until Trump, at Netanyahu's behest, tore up the deal in 2018. Netanyahu hoped Trump's next step would be an attack on Iran. That didn't happen, and the maximum pressure sanctions Trump levied failed to have the desired result. Iran chose to continue pouring billions into its nuclear and missile programs and on its regional proxies, rather than shoring up its creaking economy. But second-term Trump is a different creature. Less than 8 years after he ditched the JCPOA, they are at war together with Iran. From Ben-Gurion to begin, the pillars of Israel's national security doctrine: deterrence to prevent its enemies from attacking it, early warning to detect when they were going to do it anyway, and decisive action to ensure the wars were ended quickly and inside the enemy's territory, was tailored for a country of Israel's small size and population. It could not afford long wars and needed periods of relative calm between the wars to develop its society and economy. It was a main reason David Ben-Gurion had decided in 1948 not to pursue Israel's military advantage and Israel's war of independence rather than capture the West Bank or Gaza, as some of his generals were urging him. Ben-Gurion, partly due to Britain and France proposing a joint operation, abandoned that caution in the 1956 Sinai and Suez campaign, joining in their plan to wrest control of the Suez Canal and ultimately topple Egyptian President Nasser. What was first heralded by Ben-Gurion after swiftly occupying the Sinai Peninsula as the Third Kingdom of Israel, ended in humiliating withdrawal from Sinai under American and Soviet pressure, Ben-Gurion's old rival Menachem Begin was to learn a similar lesson a quarter of a century later when Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982 failed to yield the decisive defeat of the Palestinian National Movement and the installation of an Israel-friendly government in Beirut. Instead, it was a bloody disaster for all sides, with the IDF stuck in southern Lebanon for 18 years. It also heralded the rise of Hezbollah, Iran's most potent of proxies, which gradually expanded its control over Lebanon. In both cases, more limited military operations that would have conformed to Israel's national security doctrine to destroy Fedayeen bases in Gaza and PLO strongholds in southern Lebanon were superseded by much more ambitious war aims. The strategic aims weren't achieved and the tactical victories largely squandered. Most Israeli leaders learned the lesson: Israel can deter its neighbors and beat them in short wars, but it lacks the power to topple regimes and impose new governments. Victory for Israel is ensuring its long-term survival and prosperity in an inhospitable region. Most Israeli leaders learned the lesson: Israel can deter its neighbors and beat them in short wars, but it lacks the power to topple regimes and impose new governments. Victory for Israel is ensuring its long-term survival and prosperity in an inhospitable region. But it can't change the face of the region. It took 3 decades and 4 wars with Egypt until Anwar Sadat, acting on his own accord, came to Jerusalem to make peace. The threat of nuclear and other types of unconventional weapons, and the rise of Iran's Islamic Republic and its regional proxies, challenged the national security doctrine. Can regimes prepared to use nuclear weapons to destroy Israel be deterred? How can you deter a country with which you don't have a border and is willing to sacrifice its proxies against you rather than risking open war? The strike on Iraq's Osirak nuclear reactor in 1981 established the Begin Doctrine, under which none of Israel's enemies could be allowed to possess nuclear weapons. Olmert applied this again in 2007 when he ordered the strike on Syria's secret reactor. But Iran's nuclear program posed a different challenge. It was much broader and more widely dispersed. And Iran, with its missiles and proxies, had more means of retaliation. While Israel prepared for decades a military option in the shape of long-range airstrikes, most of its security chiefs felt there were better ways to keep Iran from reaching the nuclear threshold. Meir Dagan, the legendary Mossad chief, once said, "If a dictator has $20 billion and scientists, you won't be able to stop him forever from getting nuclear weapons." Dagan didn't mean that Israel had to accept that Iran would ultimately acquire those weapons. There were few, if any, who did as much as him to push Iran back from the nuclear threshold. But he knew it was a Sisyphean task that Israel and its allies would have to stick at, as long as Iran had a regime which held destroying Israel as one of its core missions. One day that regime would fall, but it was not something Israel could engineer. It had to focus on preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons until that day came. Open war with Iran was a last resort and Israel hadn't reached that point. Dagan was a leading member of the informal coalition of security chiefs and ministers in Netanyahu's cabinet who opposed his plan to attack Iran back in 2011-12. They were convinced a war would at most push Iran another year or two away from acquiring nuclear weapons, and that similar results could be achieved through covert operations and without risking a strategic rift with the United States, than under Barack Obama's presidency. Gambling Israel's future for political survival. The success of Hamas' surprise attack and its perpetration of the massacres of October 7 should have led to serious questioning of Israel's old doctrine. Hamas wasn't deterred. Israel didn't have early warning of the attack, and disregarded the intelligence it did have. Following the attack, instead of launching a short, decisive operation, it got bogged down for 2 years in a destructive and largely pointless war in Gaza, while being dragged into other wars with Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen, and ultimately Iran. Was this a failure of Israel's doctrine or a failure of Israeli civilian and security leadership to adhere to the doctrine? We're still waiting for the serious national reckoning necessary to address those questions. Netanyahu, though initially shell-shocked by October 7, refused to reckon with his failure. At fault, he insisted, and continues to insist, is that same security establishment who defied him over the Iran strike and withheld from him, so he claims, crucial intelligence on Hamas. Within days, Netanyahu conjured up the promise that Israel, under his leadership, would change the map of the Middle East. Originally, this was just one of the slogans of his campaign for political survival. But over the next year, the confrontation with Hezbollah, for which Israel had prepared for many years, escalated all the way to the assassination of its leader Hassan Nasrallah and the elimination of most of the movement's hierarchy. Hezbollah's decimation caused a chain reaction in neighboring Syria. Netanyahu had not predicted the downfall of the Assad regime. In fact, he was trying to secretly negotiate a deal with it whereby Syria would distance itself from Iran, only days before Bashar Assad fled Damascus. Netanyahu had not planned or predicted the downfall of the Assad regime. In fact, he was trying to secretly negotiate a deal with it whereby Syria would distance itself from Iran, only days before Bashar Assad fled Damascus. But he was quick to take credit for the rapid change of power in Syria. It was obvious, at least to him, that he was the one changing the map of the Middle East. Unlike Netanyahu, Israel's security chiefs were traumatized by October 7th and, this time around, put up little opposition to Netanyahu's plan to attack Iran. There were other arguments in favor of war. Trump was back in the White House and for the first time, it seemed there may be American support for a strike. Hezbollah, now dramatically weakened, would not be in a position to rain down thousands of missiles on Israeli cities at Iran's bidding. And the two relatively limited strikes on Iran, following Iranian missile launches in April and October 2024, had proven the Israeli Air Force was capable of penetrating Iran's air defense network. There was also intelligence Iran was about to take its nuclear and ballistic missile programs to the next level, with an aim to begin production of operational nuclear warheads. The initial aims of last June's 12-day war against Iran, removing the imminent threat of the nuclear and missile programs, could still have conformed to Israel's old doctrine. But towards the end of that war, the IF began striking at regime targets, and Netanyahu began openly musing about toppling the regime. While the 12-day war was a tactical success, it failed to achieve one of its two objectives. Iran was back producing ballistic missiles and replenishing its arsenal within a few months. Another series of airstrikes, focusing on the missile launchers and factories, was soon in planning. But the eruption of protests on the streets of Iran at the end of December and Trump's "help is on the way" promise led Netanyahu, and at least part of the security establishment, to believe regime change was finally possible. On February 28, they embarked together on Israel's most ambitious war since the failed Suez Campaign of 1956. The prize, an Iran which no longer threatens its neighbors and Israel, could indeed transform the region. But if they fail, rather than toppling the regime, which would remain entrenched, holding on to at least some of its missiles and proxies, they could topple instead the already shaky international markets. In such a case, Netanyahu may well lose the election later this year, but the deep damage done to Israel will continue for decades. Other prime ministers and probably Netanyahu himself in earlier terms would not have dreamt of taking such a gamble with the country's future. The Netanyahu doctrine is now facing its ultimate test. If together with Trump he manages to end this war without causing a global energy crisis, and within months trigger a new wave of protests inside Iran that will engulf and topple the regime, he will finally be able to claim Israel has changed the map of the Middle East. That may yet happen, but the experience Israel has accumulated over its 78 years of existence suggests otherwise. Anshul Pfeffer is the Economist Israel correspondent and author of Bibi, The Turbulent Life and Times of Benjamin Netanyahu.